Welcome to It's Bloody Complicated, the Compass podcast. I'm Neil Lawson, your host and director of Compass. These are unprecedented times, and we need to rise to the new and enormous challenges we now face. Over the next few weeks, we'll be speaking with writers, thinkers, politicians, journalists, and public service workers about how we come out of this mess in much better shape than we went in, a good society after COVID-19. These conversations have live access for Compass members who can put their own questions directly to our guests. If you'd like to participate in a live call and help support all of our work, go to compassonline.org.uk/podcast to join Compass today. Otherwise, sit back, relax, and enjoy this week's podcast. Great, let's go then. This is live. This week, we're delighted to be joined by big Compass friend and thinker, Jeremy Gilbert, to talk about his new book, co-authored with Alex Williams, Hegemony Now, How Big Tech and Wall Street Won the World and How We Will Win It Back. It's out now, published by Verso, and it'll be a great last-minute Valentine's present for the one that you love and even the ones that you don't love. Jeremy has been an intellectual driver of the radical democratic left for decades, old enough to reach back to relationships with the likes of the brilliant Stuart Hall, but young enough to DJ on the East London dance scene. Jeremy is professor of culture and political theory at the University of East London. He writes for The Guardian. He advises people like The World Transformed and NEON, the New Economy Organizers Network. And he worked closely with the Jeremy Corbyn Project. We can't have enough Jeremys. He's always been close to Compass, writing the very good pamphlet Reclaim Modernity with the late and much missed Mark Fisher, and the document The Progressive Alliance While Labour Needs It in 2017, addressing the argument in particular to those on the left of the party. Jeremy also maintains a lifelong commitment to public education outside of the academy, currently hosting his great podcast Culture, Power and Politics and regular series of free open seminars and lectures. And many other things as well. His previous books include 21st Century Socialism, The Polity, but it's Hegemony Now that we want to feature and talk about tonight. So, Jeremy, let's start where how we always do. Tell us where you are and tell us genuinely, how are you?
I'm at home in Walthamstow and in northeast London. And I'm quite stressed at the moment because I had to finish cooking the tea for the kids before jumping on the call. So I'm still recovering from that slightly rushed experience.
Are they all right? Are they well fed?
They're fine. Yeah.
Good. So Jeremy, as ever, when we do the kind of more direct one-to-ones with people on the podcast, I've said a bit about, you know, what you do, but just give us a snapshot of your political life, because I think it's really helpful to locate people in terms of, you know, their political journey and, you know, how they've got to here. So just tell us what you want to tell us about your political life.
That's where do you want to start, really? My mum originally comes from Atlanta. Family were involved in civil rights. My dad was like a sort of working class North London Jewish anarchist. So I am a child of the new left in many ways, a child of failed, unsuccessful members of the new left. My mum now has really made a good life for herself, but they were not, I was really very conscious when I came back to London, having mostly grown up in the northwest of England, having been in London when I was little, that I was being taught by the kind of people that my parents had been friends with when I was really little, but they'd all got PhDs and professorships, and my parents hadn't. Because I actually grew up mostly in the northwest of England, because that's where my dad got a job as a social worker from the mid-70s. So I had a sort of front row seat for the deindustrialization of the northwest. You know, my parents separated after a while. My dad lived in St. Helens, which is actually a coal mining town and the site of the Pilkington Glassworks. I was just talking about this in a podcast episode, another one I was recording the other day, that one of Ken Loach's first films is about a union dispute that took place at Pilkington's Glass in the 70s. And I ended up actually meeting some people, some of the guys who were involved with that. And I was around, you know, I was in St. Helens every weekend. I was there for the miners' strike. I was living in Skelmersdale, New Town in West Lancashire, which was described by the BBC at the time as one of the most deprived areas in the country. So by the time I came back down to London to go to university, like I had had a pretty formative set of political experiences, and but intellectually, I was really formed by that moment in the late 80s when people were trying to figure out what we were going to do, how essentially the left, I think, was trying to figure out collectively and in very splintered form how to respond to the historic defeats of the mid 80s. And indeed, the person who became a big the biggest intellectual influence on me was Stuart Hall, although my sort of intellectual relationship with Stuart was quite complicated, because I, on the one hand, I had wanted to, I just knew him as economist in this magazine, Marxism Today, which it's easy to for people to forget now, Marxism Today, because Marxism Today is now remembered as a sort of, by a lot of people on the left, as a sort of precursor to Blairism, which is true of a couple of the people he had writing for it, who honestly probably never should have had writing for it, to be honest. But mostly it wasn't a precursor. Mostly it was trying to articulate a position which would in some way carry forward the politics of the GLC under Ken Livingstone into a sort of national political project. And that's really where Stuart was at. But I knew Stuart as a political economist, really. And sort of parallel to that, I decided that what I really wanted to do when I left home to go to university was do a degree in cultural studies. But I didn't even know Stuart was anything to do with cultural studies. Like I knew about cultural studies from reading people like Jonathan Romney in The New Statesman and the documentaries that were made after Raymond Williams died. So these things only really converged once I was a student, and then a graduate student at Sussex. And my politics was shaped by all those factors. It was also shaped by being part of that cohort that really, for whom certain kinds of anarchism were like the only thing that was left of the radical left by the early 90s, and a certain kind of anti-authoritarianism was always part of that. But it was also shaped, my politics was also always shaped by the perceived failures of like the far left and the need to constitute kind of strategically realistic responses to the circumstances the left found itself in by the early, by the 90s, including the fragmentation of the party system and the fact that there was just no way you can actually, there was clearly no electoral route to a kind of majority left Labour government simply through the Labour Party. I mean, that was a conclusion I'd come to by the time I was 20, and one that sadly has been shown to be true ever since. So most of those positions were pretty well formed, to be honest, by the time I was in my mid-20s. To be honest, since I was 22, then I've just been saying the same stuff since then, basically, for the past 30 years. I've been saying it in different contexts, including to you and with you on many occasions.
I don't think either of us are in that much of a different position, but it is a politics shaped by defeat, isn't it, and by setback, and that isn't an electoral setback. That's the kind of sharp end of it. And maybe we'll come on to more of this, because I think in reading the book, it was really in tune with what I'm thinking about, and indeed what we're going to be planning for Compass, and members and listeners will hear more about that in the weeks and months to come. I think it's, I mean, I always like your work, Jeremy, you know that, but this is the best book you've ever done. Take us through kind of what's in it. We want people to buy it, go and buy it because it's a great read. Don't use this as a shortcut, just use this as the taster to get into it. But kind of, what tell us what the purpose of the book is. Why did you and Alex want to write it? And in particular, if you can, just get into the, I mean, people will have, on the podcast, will have heard Ken Spurs and others talk about the concept of hegemony, but you've got a particular kind of analysis of that. I mean, tell us about the rationale for the book and what do you mean by hegemony?
Okay, sure. So, well, the short answer to what we mean by hegemony, there are lots of different ways of trying to formulate in a sentence what hegemony means, but my way is the best way. And that is to say, hegemony is the capacity of any group, individual, institution, coalition of social forces, whatever, to determine the direction of travel of a broader social formation within which they are located. That is what it means. It implies a certain capacity for leadership over a broader collectivity, whether that broader collectivity is just a group of people walking down the street or whether it's an entire country or whatever. So, and why did we want to write this book? Well, I mean, the genesis of the book, to some extent, I mean, the genesis of the book is Alex was my PhD student, and he did a PhD about the relationship between hegemony and social complexity. But in the process of doing the PhD, he sort of attended some of my lectures at UVL and read some stuff I'd written or given as conference papers and never really published. And he kept saying, oh, this stuff is really important. This is central to how we should organize the concept of hegemony. And all of that, although, of course, was in response to a sense that the concept is really, really important to any kind of radical political analysis, that the ways in which people were talking about it sort of maybe 10 years ago, even a bit further ago, longer ago, when we would have both been starting to think about this, were really inadequate and needed some addressing and needed some refining. And a sense that, yeah, we had a specific understanding of what hegemony means, that it's extremely analytically useful, that we wanted to clarify for ourselves and other people and put forward. And I suppose the intellectual context, if you like, and the political context to some extent, is that what had happened to most writing on hegemony was, on the one hand, the most influential theory of hegemony and something that was a really important influence on my work and my thinking and still is, was the work of Ernesto Leclerc and Chantal Mouffe and their particular quite rarefied theorization of what hegemony might mean in their work, which is a body of work which really, it applies to Antonio Gramsci's original concept of hegemony, a set of theoretical operations drawn partly from Lacanian psychoanalysis, partly from post-structuralist and post-phenomenological philosophy. And if people don't know what those terms mean, don't worry. And it ends up with quite a powerful position analytically, but it's also one which arguably, you know, has certain limitations which we wanted to overcome in terms of how you can actually use it to analyze political situations. And on the other hand, there was a very fashionable body of opinion around about sort of 10, 12 years ago, which is that hegemony itself is just an old-fashioned concept, like it worked, that we just shouldn't use the term anymore, that we were now in a post-hegemonic historical period. Now, hegemony, I've mentioned Gramsci already, so as most people already know, the way in which, I mean, Gramsci does not originate the term hegemony, and in fact, in the English translations of Gramsci, sometimes more than one word is being translated as hegemony, but we don't have time to get into all of the history of the terminology. Broadly speaking, the way in which we use the term hegemony in contemporary political theory is mostly derived from the English translations of the writing of the Italian Marxist Antonio Gramsci, who was mostly writing in the 30s, but the stuff got translated in the early 70s, mostly. And it's in the 70s and 80s that it ended up having a huge impact on the English-speaking left. Indeed, I would say, the definition I've already given you of hegemony is pretty much the one Gramsci has. I mean, he's not going to put it in precisely those terms, but that's what he's talking about. But hegemony is often, there's a kind of simplified version of what hegemony means, which often gets circulated both by supporters and critics of Gramsci, which is that hegemony is somehow, it's a process by which a ruling class persuades everybody else or a large numbers of other people in the society to share their worldview, to agree with their worldview, to embrace as common sense their particular perspectives, their particular ideology. And the reason people in the early 2000s, a lot of people were running around saying, no, we're not in a hegemony just doesn't matter anymore, is because there was a perception that actually there wasn't very enthusiastic support for the project of the political class on the part of most of the public. You know, we had the kind of disillusion with democracy in general after the Iraq war and the fact that mass protest hadn't been able to slow it down by one week. We had the general sense of a broad fragmentation of the culture, the fact that we just weren't, we didn't, people felt that we weren't living in a culture anymore in which there was a clearly defined cultural mainstream and a clearly defined set of norms, like reproducing the assumptions of a clearly identifiable ruling class. So people were saying, no, hegemony is an old-fashioned concept. It might have applied in the 50s, like everybody thought the same way and did the same kind of jobs. It might, but it doesn't apply. It might have applied in the 80s when everybody loved Thatcher, but it doesn't apply anymore. That's what they were saying. That's not what we're saying. Our response to that is, well, no, that's just a mistaken conception of what hegemony really means, because hegemony, of course, in all of those other periods, you know, whether you're talking about the 80s with Thatcher, whether you're talking about the 50s and the so-called post-war consensus, of course, it was never really the case that you had like a clear majority of people definitely in favour of this one thing that everybody was signed up to. It was always a much more complex, it was bloody complicated. It was a much more complicated situation than that. And it's also the case that the situation people were pointing to in the earlier in this millennium and saying, oh, well, people don't really, most people don't really enthusiastically endorse the political project of Blair or whatever, and therefore hegemony isn't in operation. And we said that's also missing the point, because, and this is something that Mark Fisher, for example, I think was trying to get at with some of his analysis of capitalist realism. Really, what we understood and what we still understand to a large extent to be going on during the era of neoliberal hegemony, the era when neoliberalism can be said to be hegemonic from the 80s, to arguably up to the present, maybe only up to about 2015 or something, is not that it's not that most people enthusiastically endorse neoliberalism and its aims and objectives and assumptions. It's that they see themselves as not really being in a position to effectively challenge it. So they defer to it. And it's that deferral to the power and interest of a particular powerful groups and the necessity to some extent to go along with what they want you to go along with, which we see is really key to understanding the way hegemony usually works, like in most historical contexts. So what we see is a situation developing really over the course of the 70s, 80s, 90s into the 2000s, in which a particular constellation of social forces, I mean, on our account, it's mainly, as we keep saying in the book, as the title has it, it's Wall Street and Silicon Valley, it's big tech and the finance sector. That constellation of forces is able to engineer a situation whereby most people in a society like Britain's, even if they don't like it, they see themselves as having to go along with a particular set of norms, a general political and economic project, which is fundamentally serving the interests of that group. And in order to make that analysis, we had to really revise the kind of version of hegemony that was being promoted by people like Leclerc and Mouffe, to the extent that they didn't really have a conception of interests. They had really got to the point of understanding hegemony as a process by which different sets of ideas interact with each other. Some ideas become normative, they become common sense, others don't. But we think they had somewhat lost track of the relationship between those processes and questions of material interests.
Yeah.
So to some extent, our objective in the book is to bring back this notion of material interest as central to understanding political processes and political change, but to do so in a way which doesn't simply go back to a sort of old-fashioned, simplified, vulgar Marxism, which assumes that everybody or any group or individual only has one identifiable set of interests based on their class position. We recognise is, well, actually, you can more usefully understand individuals and groups as always having complex and multiple sets of interests that could be realised under differing historical circumstances in different scenarios. So that's one of this kind of central theoretical arguments in the book. One of the central theoretical arguments in the book, I mean, the way this really cashes out in terms of more everyday political language is that we think that it's not useful usually to assume that what motivates people politically is values and identity, which is the kind of assumption in a lot of liberal and political theory and even cultural theory in recent years. We think that generally speaking, what's motivating people is some sense of where their material interests lie. But of course, at the same time, you have to have an expansive understanding of what you mean by material interests. So it doesn't just mean like what your bank balance is going to be at the end of the week. It means how secure you're likely to feel 5 years from now. It means how free you feel to walk down the street. So, you know, women and trans people and people of colour have a material interest in having their freedom to walk down the street realised under particular circumstances. So, and why is that? I mean, why that's important is partly because a lot of the political milieu that I found myself in over the much of the past few decades, really, especially in the early 21st century, was one in which it was just sort of taken for granted by people. Whether you're talking about radical activists in the Green movement, or whether you're talking about people around things like Compass on the soft left, it was really just taken for granted that actually what motivates people is something called value. So what motivates some people is some sort of psychological disposition, which they acquire more or less mysteriously, which they just have, and which you just have to kind of react to in some sense. And from our point of view, that, you know, that set of assumptions really, you know, it leaves you unable to really get to grips with the question of how people's conceptions of their values and their identities relate to their material circumstances and also their sense of material possibility in the future. So taking all those assumptions and that kind of theoretical position, what much of the book does is try to give a complex historical account of the emergence of neoliberal hegemony out of the breakdown of the post-war consensus in the 70s. I mean, really, we try to give it a quite detailed historical analysis of the emergence of the whole post-war settlement as well from the 40s onwards, because we think it's always central to debates on the left, even today. You know, what were the conditions that made 1945 possible? You know, not because you can replicate them, because that is the only big success the left in Britain has ever had, basically. It's the only one we can really point to. So we have to understand what was it that made that possible? And by analysing that at an appropriate level of abstraction, you know, what lessons can we draw about what isn't possible, you know, now?
Do you want to just concretize that for listeners, Jeremy, in terms of what were some of the specifics of the 1945 moment, which you know led to political victory and some level of political hegemony, and then we might move on to quickly what replaced that from 79, sure. And then let's finish before we bring people in to what we think some of the building blocks of the future might be. So 45, start with that and make it concrete for people.
Well, obviously one of the major conditions, as everybody knows, is the unreplicable conditions of a, you know, total crisis of World War II. But from the point of view of what useful lessons you can draw about understanding that situation, I think you have to bracket that out, because we're probably, yeah, we might find ourselves in a comparable situation, but we can't engineer one. I would say the first thing to understand about the shift that takes place between the 30s, say 1932, the moment when in America they're starting to get the New Deal, but in Britain we're entering into like 8 years of just liberal austerity, like the last hurrah of Victorian liberalism, in a sense. What changes between that and the mid-40s, firstly, is a change in the class structure, actually a change in the class composition of the middle class in Britain. You get a shift from a situation in which the middle classes from in the early 30s are still basically look like the middle classes of the Victorian times. They're what Marx calls the petty bourgeoisie. They're mostly entrepreneurs, they're self-employed, they're culturally and politically deferential to the haute bourgeoisie and even the traditional nobility. By the 1940s, you've got this new section of the professional classes, which is really most clearly represented and sort of by the ideas and project of the Fabian Society. And they are salaried sort of technocrats. Yeah? They're engineers. Yeah? They're people with degrees. A lot of them are not self-employed. A lot of them are working for state enterprises or private enterprises. But you know, on a certain level, they're workers. So they have a very different conception of what their relationship to the state might be and what their relationship to the wider working class might be. And that is a really key, and they become a key component of the coalition of forces that makes the 45 settlement possible. Conversely, you've also got the situation that, you know, you can draw a through line. You can focus very clearly, I think, just if you want to, just focus on the experience of the South Wales miners. South Wales miners, the most strategically important coal fields in Britain, because they produce the highest quality coal, but also culturally, politically, the most militant section of the working class in Britain, one of the most militant sections of the working class in the organised working class in Europe. They'd been thoroughly radicalised by the experience of the Great General Strike in 1926. I mean, they'd been radicalised before that, or the 20s, or the Great General Strike wouldn't have happened. They'd been through the experience of the 30s, the kind of the hungry 30s, which had been in many ways demoralising, but had also engendered a real culture of solidarity and a determination not to go back to that. And then in the 1940s, they're finding themselves in a situation where the demands of the industrial economy, the demand for coal in particular, created not just by the war effort, but by the industrialization that carries on after that, means that they've got real, real bargaining power. And they bring to bear that combination of militancy and bargaining power of making a series of political demands, which end up being effectively, you know, personified in the person and the political agenda of Nye Bevin. And it's always really important to understand this. Like, you only get the National Health Service in the form that we still know it today, as on a socialist model, not a subscription service, not an insurance-based model, which is what Ernie Bevin wanted, for example. You know, it's what Attlee probably would have preferred, personally, if you'd asked him privately. You only get it on that socialist model because you've got this militant section of the working class, strategically crucial, committed to a radical politics, and concessions have to be made to them. But ultimately, it's this coalition of forces. It's this coalition of forces, this extremely militant section of the working class, and this relatively new and kind of forward-looking section of the middle class, who come together to really make possible that social democratic settlement after the war. What lessons can you learn from all that? Well, the lessons you can learn from all that are pretty simple, and maybe they're pretty predictable. Maybe you don't need a lot of historical analysis to draw those lessons, but they are that they're really. Firstly, you need a broad coalition of class forces and social forces and political forces to be able to get done anything as dramatic as the post-war Labour government gets done. And that coalition of social forces must include at least some elements who are really militant in their politics. And I think that was the mistake, to be honest, which I think the soft left made in Britain in the 80s and 90s, was to lose sight of the fact that without that element of militancy, you will just get swallowed up by capitalist agendas. But you also need, you know, you also need on a sort of rhetorical level and on an ideological level, you need a kind of confidence in a vision of the future, which even if it's just a technocratic vision of the future, which I think, to be honest, that is what most of the politicians and most of the middle classes at that time had. I don't think most of them weren't really radical socialists, but you need that as a necessary component of a political project. And I think that's still the case today. It's still the case today that any successful progressive political project is going to need to involve a coalition of quite diverse social forces. It's going to have to include some element of militancy, but it can't only include revolutionary militant elements, not unless you really do have a revolutionary majority in the society, which we don't have. And it needs some kind of a vision of the future. It needs to be able to make a case to the unaligned sections of the public that it has an idea of the future that it can deliver to people. Does that make sense?
It does. It makes a lot of sense. So before we bring in some other people, maybe two things. Firstly, say something about kind of, you know, bring that into the Progressive Alliance. And the nature of those alliances, particularly with, you know, between socialists and liberals, you know, and I guess Greens as well, Jeremy. But okay. also just that difference between a kind of transformative kind of project and a reformist one, and definitely the place I think, you know, we need to get compass to, you know, learning from what you've been saying and what's in the book is that. You know, we don't expect any incoming new government to change society in, you know, one term. What we expect is building blocks so that we become more hegemonic, more powerful, exert more leadership over time. And just maybe talk us through that a little bit and what some of those building blocks are that you see are kind of critical to build up that capacity so that we do a version of 1945 in 1925. And beyond. So Progressive Alliance bit first, and then kind of stages, building blocks that you see as critical.
Okay. Well, I mean, for one thing, I mean, to understand why the sort of the Progressive Alliance becomes, I mean, you know, I mean, arguably any progressive political coalition is a sort of progressive alliance. I mean, what I've been describing is a sort of progressive alliance. But conveniently for the Labour Party in 1945, it was able to contain almost all, the Labour Party institutionally was able to contain almost all of that alliance. The Liberals were very small. I mean, they still played an important role. Beveridge, who wrote the Beveridge Report, was a Liberal, but you know, the Labour Party was able to contain it. What happens over the next few decades, what happens, you know, by the mid-70s, is that society in all kinds of ways is becoming more complicated. The sense of a kind of coherent national project is completely broken down. The demands of militant labour, of sections of the middle class, of older people, of, you know, people with different ethnicities, different genders, can't really be contained in the same way. And it's in that context, when with the breakdown of that post-war contention in the 70s, that the neoliberals are really able to emerge as the most powerful force in society in some ways. And they are able to offer, and essentially they are able, the neoliberals who have been hanging around for decades, like being considered obscure freaks for the most part, are able to offer to some people in government, to some sections of the capitalist class, they're able to offer them a set of recipes, a set of solutions for dealing with the crisis which emerges in the 70s. And then what happens over the next few decades is society continues to become more pluralistic, the culture continues to feel rather more fragmented. And the neoliberals are able to implement their project largely because nobody else is able to get together a coherent counterblock, not because neoliberalism is ever really popular. I think this is always really important to understand. It is a key point I've been making for years. It's a key point that we make in the book. That for the most part, if you look at what happens, you know, over the course of the 70s, 80s, 90s, the way in which people's compliance with the neoliberal project of Thatcher and then the Blair government is engineered is not by persuading them that privatizing public services, cutting taxes for the rich, smashing the unions, etc., is a good idea. It's just by bribing people. It's just by allowing people to experience a huge expansion in their capacity for private consumption. And it, you know, is always worth keeping in mind, like most of us today, even those who are quite poor, the material conditions under which we live are in many ways sort of very luxurious compared to those of people a few decades earlier. You know, we have massive TVs, we have cheaper travel, we have all very different food. So people are sort of bought off, but also the kind of political situation is engineered whereby it's very, very difficult for any kind of coherent alternative program to emerge. And, you know, part of the condition of possibility for that in Britain is the fact that the party system, which never really does take the form of a clearly identifiable two-party structure. It never really does have that structure, but it almost gets to that in the 40s and 50s when the Liberal vote really shrinks small and the Nationalists haven't really emerged yet. That party structure undergoes a really significant transformation. And it's already clear, really, to anybody who's being realistic by the mid-80s that we're not going back to the world of, you know, two big party blocks like we had in the 50s. The break, especially the fragmentation across the centre and the centre left between Labour, the Liberal Democrats, the SDP, and then later the Green Party and then the Nationalist parties, is not really a reversible process as much as people would like it to be. And under those circumstances, you combine those circumstances with two other circumstances, the fact of the first past the post electoral system and a media press system, a media press ecology, which is heavily biased, not just against any other particular group, but in favour of the Conservative Party. And you end up on a Conservative political agenda more broadly. You end up in a situation where Labour is going to find itself in a perpetual political dilemma, which is, you've got your support concentrated in cities, you've got your support in places where you're getting huge majorities, but it's not distributed evenly across the country in such a way that you can easily get a parliamentary majority. And the only way you can get a parliamentary majority, in fact, is by winning over Tory voters, is by persuading soft Tory voters to vote for you. So you have to orient your entire political agenda towards those soft Tory voters. That's ultimately how Blair, you know, gets elected in 97. And more on a more sort of structural level, I mean, Blair only really gets to form a government because he and Smith and Mo Mowlam and Gordon Brown had successfully convinced key figures in the City of London and Rupert Murdoch that they would all have an effective veto over any Labour programme. So they wouldn't use their power, their institutional power and their media power to persuade swing voters not to vote Labour anymore, as they had been doing for the past 15 years or so. And so far, you know, under these circumstances, as far as anybody can see, as far as the empirical evidence is that we have, you know, that's the only way you get a Labour government. You only get a Labour government under those circumstances by really abandoning any notion of a radical reforming programme like the 45 programme, and instead, you know, putting together a particular coalition of forces which basically excludes a lot of your voting base in the city. So the left voting base really excludes about 25% of the electorate who are like proper socialists, and just freezes them out of the political system. Now, why the Progressive Alliance has been such an important idea for people on certain parts of the left for the past few decades is because it's the only plausible alternative electoral strategy under those circumstances. Under those circumstances I've been describing, the only plausible alternative is to try to maximise the efficiency of the anti-Tory vote. So rather than Labour trying to win Tory votes in large numbers in order to form a government, you maximise the efficiency of the vote of the anti-Tory majority. That is basically what the Progressive Alliance is a strategy, you know, designed to try to do. So, and I mean, that is why I'm sure most people on this call are aware that that is why people like me and you have been arguing for that ever since really the moment at the end of the 80s, when it became apparent that we were just not going back to the two-party world of the 40s and 50s. And I think that all the experience of the past few years has shown that we were right, that even under the most propitious possible circumstances, such as in 2017, you know, a left-led Labour government just wasn't able to beat the odds which were stacked against it by the combination of the electoral system and a hostile media and press. And so without a politics which recognises the necessity of the kind of broad social coalition that made 1945 possible, but also recognises that the institutional circumstances have changed so radically since 45 that it can't just look like the 45 government getting elected again. Without a recognition of both of those things, there is just no serious chance of ever, ever getting a progressive government in this country.
Hello, Samuel here from the Compass office. I hope you're enjoying the discussion so far. It's Bloody Complicated is brought to you by Compass, and it's made possible by the support of our amazing members, like Eliza. Here's Eliza on why she joined the Compass community.
My name is Eliza. I've been a Compass member for about 3 or 4 years, I think. What drew me to Compass was the fact that it's cross-party and it's also not a party. I had a light bulb moment about elections, which was no one's going to win except the Tories under this system, and we have to work together. Having been previously a member of the Labour Party and then joining the Green Party, I really wanted to see parties working together, and we have people that are politicians, MPs, trade union leaders, etc. And it's quite level. There's no big hierarchy. It's quite an honest, open space where people come together. You will hear from people from all around the political spectrum actually debating the hard stuff. It's actually, let's find a solution to the problems that we have and let's do it together. We need this progressive alliance. And I would like to see people who are passionate about getting the Tories out in the next election and getting proportional representation in. Come and join Compass now and actually swell the movement, because without people, there's no power. And that's what we need right now.
Find out more about joining the Compass community at compassonline.org.uk/podcast. And now, back to the discussion.
That was a brilliant analysis of the Progressive Alliance. We'll come back to the building blocks thing maybe at the end. Bring in any of the great questions that have come in so far. And you're getting rave reviews in the chat, Jeremy, just if you didn't know it. Go on, Brian, you're up first.
Yeah, okay, thank you. I very much like the analysis, Jeremy. I just have this doubt at the back of my mind. I was massively influenced by Gramsci, but also massively influenced by a book dating, I think, from the early 90s by J.K. Galbraith called The Culture of Contentment. And what that basically speaks to is just like the dead weight of inertia, that enough people are doing okay, that they'll go along with stuff. And if we're up against that, and then, you know, you look in the wildest dreams you might have, you could see crowds in the streets supporting radical policies in Parliament as a Maidan type of moment. And I just find it impossible to think that even that peaceful revolutionary idea has got any type of traction whatsoever, because we've come so far backward in our analysis and in persuading people to say, look, there are alternatives that work, but they just don't see them. The fact that massive amounts of the economy are cooperative, for example, goes completely by the board.
Brilliant question, Brian. Let's get the others in. And then, so Jeremy, you've got the culture of contentment one. Bill, are you up next? Go on.
Yeah. Hi, Jeremy. I think the question was just actually linking to, you talked about the media's role in hegemony, but I'm interested in social media, because I remember in the late 90s, you know, the kind of, you know, the World Wide Web and the optimism about this new kind of almost common space for debate and progressives to coalesce. And then what you've had is effectively enclosure through Facebook and Twitter. You know, that public space has become privatized. And I'm interested in the role you think that's playing, because you can argue the right has been very effective in using social media to almost reinforce, you know, a negative direction of travel for the left. And I just, you know, I know that's the part of your title of your book, but I'm interested in just understanding your perspective on that, you know, more, and what the space, opportunity space for the left to counteract that is.
Brilliant. Thanks, Bill. Samuel, is there one other question we can get in from the ones in the chat or in the Q&A?
Yep. And the one chat from Compass member John: is technology an asset or liability, or maybe an odd combination of both in offering a challenge to hegemony?
That was a great question, Brian. I think, and it is the problem which Galbraith identified has been one of the really intractable ones for the left. And indeed, it was part of the condition of possibility for the whole turn to the New Labour project, that some people, like Brown himself, like Gordon Brown, I think himself actually, became quite convinced that Galbraith's analysis was right. And it meant that the left just, you couldn't have a conventional left project. All you could do was sort of try to look after the poorest people on the sly, almost. I think it's true. I think from our perspective in the book, this is a really interesting question to think about, because we would say, well, firstly, if you really do have a culture of contentment, if you really do have a situation where you cannot break up the coherence of that two-thirds block who are happy with how everything is going, then yeah, you're really in trouble. There's nothing you can, there is, it's true, there's nothing you can do under those circumstances. So what you have to do then, but it's only going to be under very rare circumstances that really is true and that is unbreakable, although there's always going to be challenges. You have to identify the sections of that apparently contented two-thirds who are the least contented, and you have to identify them and you have to work on them specifically. Not only the least contented, I would say, in terms of being unhappy and put upon and oppressed, but also the least contented in terms of being relatively easy to persuade that it might be worth trying some other project. I mean, this is it's a point we do try to make in the book, actually, that, you know, the left often makes the mistake of assuming that it's going to be the poorest people, the most exploited people, will be the easiest to mobilize. Sometimes that's true, often it's not, because part of the whole point about oppression is it disempowers you. Often what you have to, I think one of the mistakes the left in this country makes repeatedly is it doesn't do the strategic work of saying, look, who are the people who currently are not really with us, but who would be the easiest for us to win over? And being easiest to win over for the left doesn't usually mean, to be honest, being like the poorest and most oppressed. It often it involves having quite high levels of education, as we saw in the 40s in the example I gave. It involves people who the left is able to reach quite easily. You know, the example I've been giving in talks the past few years is school teachers. Like school teachers in Britain are, you know, far too acquiescent. They're far more acquiescent politically, historically, than they are in a lot of other countries. And they should be really low-hanging fruit for the left. You know, they're well-educated. They're quite easy to talk to. They're on the front line of neoliberal reform and they all hate it. So that's a sort of example. Now, the other thing there is this whole question of contentment, really, because contentment, on our analysis, is partly a function of the extent to which you do or don't recognise, or you do or don't believe, that some better situation for you and your social group might be plausibly achievable in the recognisable future. And this is really, really crucial for us. I think it's always really important. It's really important for socialists to understand that there's all kinds of empirical evidence. If you go around and ask people, just, you know, in an ideal world, like what is it you would like to see happen in this country over the next 10 years? What they all describe is a transition to socialism. The real stumbling block is that most of them don't think that's possible. And they think that if you try to do it, you'll just get hammered. And they might be right. I mean, this is part of the problem. Like, it might be, we might have to sort of think about the fact that all those people, you know, who were telling focus groups and telling journalists that they'd voted Labour all their lives, but now they were going to vote Tory because voting Labour all their lives had got them nowhere. This is what they were saying in parts of the Red Wall in 2019. They weren't just confused. They were actually making a very sober assessment and thinking, well, you know, we could get Corbyn, but in effect, you know, Corbyn government would just be defeated by capital within a couple of years. You know, we might be better off getting the kind of sponsorship of a corrupt, you know, Tory MP who can get a few things for our local area. So the task is to convince people that what you want to do is possible, not that it's desirable. And a key thing then is convincing people that what you want to do is possible is not just showing them the clever plan. It's not just coming up with the clever policy. So this is how we would do it. It's actually convincing people that you have a big enough coalition of forces that you would be able to confront the inevitable opposition that you would face. But this comes back to the question of the Progressive Alliance. I mean, one of the best arguments for the Progressive Alliance, in my view, from a left perspective rather than a liberal or centrist perspective, one of the best arguments is, look, you need something really special to convince people who are sceptical that despite that all your lovely promises about a radical reform programme are actually deliverable. You need something really special. You need something that looks historically distinctive and unique. You look something that doesn't look like politics has looked over the past few decades. And arguably, like a multi-party coalition, you know, would look like that. So that is, you know, one way of addressing that question. OK, I'll move on to the other. I mean, the two questions around the media and technology and social media, I think, can be answered together, really. Well, look, in any given historical situation, I would say a new technology almost always benefits those who already have the most power and resources, because new technologies are inevitably expensive and resource intensive. And what always happens with the adoption of new technologies is it takes a certain length of time for less powerful social groups to figure out ways of using them to their own advantage and figuring out new forms of organisation. And one way of understanding the whole historical period we've been living through since the 50s is that the incredible cybernetic revolution, the revolution in communications and information technology, of course, was always going to benefit capitalists before anyone else. And they used it to undermine the whole industrial and economic and social basis of the post-war settlement. They used it to undermine the power of unions, et cetera, over a period of decades and to entrench their own position. And it took until very recently for us to get ourselves into a position where sometimes progressive forces could use some of those technologies to their advantage. I think it is important when thinking about things like social media to recognize that, well, social media, even Facebook, for example, are not all bad for the left. The Corbyn leadership would not have happened without Facebook. It would not have happened without Facebook groups enabling a whole population of leftists in this country who had mostly been told for decades that they were isolated and fragmented and minuscule in number, to suddenly become aware that actually there weren't just a few hundred of them in a few pubs in northeast London. You know, there were hundreds of thousands of them. There were enough of them to take over the Labour Party if they wanted to. It was absolutely crucial to that. Of course, you know, subsequent to the enormous shock which the political class got and even the capitalist class got in Britain at the realisation that left-wing forces were using social media, they were using the campaigning apps that Momentum developed, they were using this combination of new technology and old-fashioned organising and canvassing to almost win an election in 2017. Of course, since then, in the subsequent 4 or 5 years, there's been a major backlash. And one reason for the extraordinary behaviour of the Labour leadership over the past couple of years in just completely egregiously just flouting any normal civilized norms of democratic accountability is because they got absolutely terrified. They were absolutely terrified by what happened during that period when it became apparent that it wasn't completely untrue, the hopes of the late 90s, that people could use social media to organize themselves democratically. So, and that's the context we're in right now. Right now, we're in a situation where, in fact, it turned out that some of those hopes weren't totally naive. It took quite a long time to get there. There were limited and uneven results. There were all kinds of very bad things. And of course, the right is able to use social media to its own advantage. The right has billions and billions of dollars to spend on using them, media to its own, social media and traditional media to their own advantage. So of course they're able to. Of course it's harder for us to use them to our advantage because we're weaker, we're poorer. But I think right now we have to understand we're experiencing a backlash against the fact that it became apparent both here and in the Bernie Sanders campaign in the States that a kind of creative combination of traditional forms of organisation and some of these new technologies did have the potential to actually create very potent collectivities, to use this term I often like to use, to create very potent political force and democratic political forces. So I don't think we can just sort of shrug our shoulders and give up in the face of that. I think we have to recognise that historically, the only thing that ever enables non-elite forces to make any kind of gains in the context of dramatic technological change is finding ways of using those technologies and combining them with very creative forms of organisation. And I think, honestly, we're still in quite an early stage in the history of learning how to do that. And that is that is part of what it means to be on the left in the 21st century, is to be engaged in a constant process of working out, okay, how do we organise ourselves in this technological environment, which has only really existed for about 20 years now, and is very, very different from the technological environment of industrial capitalism, in which the left, as we know it, developed over 200 years.
Thanks, Jeremy. So take us on from that, and we're going to have to sort of begin to think about winding up. So give us the critique of what Corbynism got wrong in that, because they didn't adopt the politics of alliance building in the sense that we would understand it. Why not? Why was that a failure? And what is the politics that we have to prosecute? You know, what's the alliance? I mean, obviously, there is the electoral alliance building around a progressive alliance. But, you know, what are the other things? You've mentioned teachers, and I think education is a site, you know, for hegemony building. But, you know, what are the others, you know, and leave us with some staging posts. So a bit about the critique of Corbyn, you know, what did he get wrong on that stuff and what do we learn from that? And leave us with a kind of, you know, a direction of travel that we'd expect from a Compass podcast about where we take the debate next, you know, given the ups and downs of Starmerism, the weakness of that political project, given the analysis that you've given of 1945, you know, and how deep and enduring that was. We don't have anything like the assets, the political assets that, you know, Starmer doesn't have compared to then. So what do we have to be building over the medium to long term to build up the prospects for the kind of good society we want? Progressive Alliance and then those longer term building blocks before we finish.
Okay, well, cool. Well, I mean, my own analysis, as you know, and this is, you know, self-serving for you and me as sort of advocates of the Progressive Alliance, is that, you know, the Corbyn project was lost in April 2017 when they dismissed out of hand the calls of the SNP and the Green Party for a Progressive Alliance. because they were never, just the electoral facts were, they were never going to get a parliamentary majority. And if they didn't get a parliamentary majority, you know, the Tories would form a government. And they should have, and that should have been, you know, absolutely at the top of everybody's mind. And it wasn't. It wasn't partly because they never thought they were going to get that close to winning anyway. So they didn't think they were going to have to. I mean, to be honest, I mean, like, yeah, you and I were having these arguments with people very close to Corbyn, and some of them very much agreed with us, and some of them didn't. Even the ones who did agree with us recognised that it would be a really tough sell to a lot of their members and support their supporters in organisations like Momentum, that we want to do a deal with the hated Liberal Democrats who've just inflicted 5 years of coalition on you and austerity. And they didn't want to bother having those arguments because they didn't think they were anywhere close to forming a government. So why bother? Like, why bother having those arguments at that stage? It's also partly because they didn't know what the hell was going on. And I wrote an article for the South Atlantic Quarterly about this, saying, well, if you really asked the people right at the centre of the project, like Corbyn, what did they think was happening? I think what they thought was happening was the historical vindication of Bennism. Basically, they thought that the history was now proving them right, like that by waiting it out for long and staying pure for long enough, history might deliver them a victory. And they just weren't interested in the sort of stuff, Gramscian stuff we're interested in, like analysing the conjuncture, like building a coalition. It's just not how they think about politics, not how Corbyn thinks about politics. So that was that. I would also say, to be fair, I just don't think I don't think the political movement around Corbyn was anything like mature enough to expect that level of sophisticated analysis to come out of it. So I don't think we can really say, yeah, it could have happened if only they'd listened to us. I sort of think, like, on one level, I think that's true. And on another level, that itself would be sort of naive. Well, where can we go? Like, what, you know, I mean, the question, and it was the question, it's the issue raised by Brian's question, really, is, well, you know, where are the, you know, what are the sites and sources of discontent that we might be able to assemble into a coherent coalition? And I think, you know, where are the kind of, you know, we are in a very strange position right now. We're in a very strange position right now in Britain because it's pretty clear. I mean, you only have to look at the opinion polls. It's pretty clear there is actually a majority, you know, who want a clearly identifiable social democratic programme. And the main reason that isn't on offer to them right now is because the sort of residual political class, what we call in the book Hegemony Now, the professional political class, this technocratic managerial class who emerge in the 80s and 90s with the job of basically administering neoliberalism on behalf of finance capital and the tech sector. Those guys are still around. They are very entrenched in their institutions, whether it's the Guardian politics desk or the Labour Party regional offices. And they do not want, I mean, the last thing they want is to accept that we are now in a very different historical period from the one that we were in 10, 15 years ago and when they were growing up. And that really, you know, what the public want is the kind of social democratic project they've spent the past 30 years telling themselves and us can never be implemented again. So they don't want it. So in some ways, it's a very fragile situation. You know, in some ways, we're in a situation in which the strategic conditions should really be on our side, but the tactical and institutional specificities of the situation make things very difficult for us because, you know, that clique managed to recapture the Labour Party machinery while the pandemic was happening. And right now they're using it to, you know, we all know what they're using it for. We can see what they're using it for. I think in terms of the broader social politics, though, I think this is significant. I think in terms of the broader social politics, what is the real challenge facing us right now? The real challenge facing us now is not convincing the young or convincing really anyone under 45 that we need radical change, that the whole system is broken and we need something better. That is not the challenge. None of those people are voting Tory anymore. None of them even, you know, they're all well to the left of Starmer. Like, not all, but like statistically significant majority of them are. We've got basically no chance, in my opinion, of winning back the pensioners who are defending their own material interests to the last by defending the value of their assets and their paid for houses and their pension funds. And of course, I realise there will be plenty of people on that call who are themselves pensioners. But like we all know, sadly, you're not a majority, as Polly Toynbee was saying in The Guardian today, of that generation. I sort of think, in some sense, the sort of battleground is sort of people. I mean, if you this is just true in terms of if you look at the sophology, the voting patterns, the battleground is those people who are sort of our generation, Neil, sort of between my age and your age, people who mostly vote, like, especially you talk about people my age, I'm in my early 50s now, mostly voted Labour in 2017, then a lot switched in 2019 to voting for the Lib Dems or the Greens or not voting. And that's one of the reasons we did so badly in 2019. They're people who are really pretty comfortable up until very recently. They're not the people who for whom the crash in 2008 really hurt them. Now, they're the people like me who've been practically paid to live in their house for the past 10 years with a low interest rate. They're the guys who still look back to 2012, even though we had a Tory government by then, misty-eyed at what a great country it was when the Olympics was happening, and are kind of were insulated from the fact that riots were happening in London the year before and that prospects for young people were deteriorating really rapidly. Those are the constituencies who right now, I think, they're up for grabs, but they're very confused about what the hell is going on. They're very confused by Starmer. You know, he's not doing what they thought, what he said he was going to do when they voted for him, because some of them are in the Labour Party. They're very kind of perplexed. They're very up for grabs. They're very, very worried about things like climate change. And I think the question, I mean, the whole question is, yeah, how do we bring those people into a coalition with younger people, with people with poorer people? How do we bring those into a coalition which is able to really put forward a progressive politics? How do we convince them that such a thing is even possible and achievable? Well, I don't have a magic formula for that. I think partly that I don't have a magic formula. But I think that is the task. I think that is the task for it. That is going to be the key task of progressive politics over the next 5 to 10 years. The key task is going to persuade that social constituency not to sort of go the way of the boomers and just become an obstruction, you know, and just to become sort of enemies of the youth who are becoming increasingly discontent, increasingly, but also increasingly alienated from politics.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
That's the task, Jeremy. Thanks so much for that. That was fantastic. That was a brilliant conversation, or a brilliant listening experience. So thank you for that, Jeremy. Thank you for the book. Everyone, get the book, read it. It's brilliant. The next podcast will be at 6 p.m. on Tuesday, the 28th of February, when Francis will be joined by Anthony Barnett to discuss his important and linked idea of the definite left, as he calls it. And joining them to discuss that paper will be none other than Caroline Lucas MP. So make sure you tune in then. Until then, thanks again, Jeremy. Thanks to everyone on the call tonight, for all of our members. If you're listening and you haven't joined yet, please do so. You need to help us win hegemony now. And everyone needs a compass to navigate these complex times. Please, everyone, keep safe, keep well, keep hopeful. Until the next time, good night.
So, if you like what you've heard today and want to be part of a much more equal, democratic and sustainable future, a good society, then visit us at compassonline.org.uk/podcast, and you'll be able to join us live on future calls just like this one. You can tweet me at Neil, N-E-A-L underscore compass, or compass at Compass Office. And if you've enjoyed this week's episode, please give us a rating. It will help us reach more listeners in the future. And it's only fair that they know it's bloody complicated too.